I wonder what you'd say if someone asked you about your experience of church, not just now, but at an earlier stage of life. Some of us have never had any experience of church apart from St. John's, but for others, especially older ones among us, that may well not be so. My own early experience of church when I was still at primary school age was certainly very different from what we experience today. It involved every Sunday leaving our fairly isolated home in the Suffolk countryside, piling into the family car and driving 6 miles through the countryside to the coastal town of Orford. Not quite coastal, but not far. And in Orford, there is a vast, magnificent 14th century church building, which is one of the architectural marvels of the area, and it resulted from the thriving medieval wool trade. And in the church at Orford, every Sunday morning, there was sung Eucharist, and a small congregation in this vast church most Sundays, and an even smaller robed choir, in which my mother from time to time was persuaded to warble. It was all presided over by a most godly Anglo-Catholic vicar, a very lovely man, who watched over the whole. But I had no idea at all what was going on. Absolutely none. I found it all extremely tedious. But mercifully, I was allowed to read Richard Crompton's William stories to keep me quiet. But we had to be smart to go to church at Orford, which meant putting on a jacket and tie and smart trousers. Yes, I was 9 or 10. Things have changed a bit. And I never liked getting ready for church in that way. And one Sunday morning, when I was making more fuss than usual, my father said to me very gently, "Yes, Charles, I know it's a bore having to dress up to go to church like this. To be honest," he said, "I don't think Jesus minds what we wear in church. But the thing is, the vicar does." And I was about 9 or 10, I think, at the time. I've always remembered that comment, especially coming from my father, who was a very private man and didn't often vouchsafe his thoughts about church and faith. But it was a comment that made a profound impression on me. It taught me that Jesus and church aren't quite the same thing, and I hadn't realized that before. More than that, it implied that Jesus was still very much around, even if we couldn't see him. He doesn't mind what we wear, rather than he wouldn't have minded what we wear. And it also taught me that though we should be rightly sensitive to the vicar's feelings, what really mattered was Jesus and his view of things. And I liked the sound of Jesus, this Jesus. He seemed to understand me. He would take me as I was. He wouldn't make me dress up smartly. He wasn't somebody who would make a fuss about jackets and ties. And I rather like the sound of that. I don't think Jesus minds what we wear in church, but the thing is, the vicar does. Well, it was a long time ago, very long time ago, but it's a scene which still, to me, is very vivid and very significant and actually still very helpful. And it's the sort of thing we have in a very much deeper sense, if you forgive the comparison. It's what we have in a very much deeper sense in John 13. In fact, it's what we have all the way through John's Gospel. What we have is carefully selected incidents from Jesus' public ministry, just a few of them, each one in turn explained, sometimes by the writer, sometimes by Jesus himself, sometimes both. And this scene of his washing the disciples' feet shortly before his own arrest and crucifixion was profoundly etched on their collective memory, not just what he did, but what he said. And it was especially etched on the memory of Peter, I guess, his disciple and his friend. It was a very surprising, in fact, a very shocking thing for him to do. If I were to do it on the pavement outside before an evening service, or maybe down at Victoria Place or something, it would simply be rather odd, wouldn't it? And if I was wearing a dog collar, people would pass it by and say, "Well, vicars are even stranger than I thought." If I were to kneel down there and start washing people's feet. But Jesus' action is very different. It's laden with symbolism, because this is something that only a servant or only a slave would do. In that hot and dusty society, you would have sandals at most on your feet, and they would need a good wash. And for Jesus to kneel down and wash his disciples' feet is rather as if the queen turned up at your front door with dray cloths and things and started to clean your loo. And you wouldn't just be surprised, you'd actually be rather shocked. You'd say, "You shouldn't be doing this. You know, if anything, I should come to Buckingham Palace and clean your loo." But we wouldn't want it. And we want her to stop. And that's exactly what happens here. You see, Peter is shocked. Lord, do you wash my feet? And then, you'll never wash my feet. But Jesus does it anyway. And we need to understand why. At the time, they don't understand. Jesus says, verse 7, what I'm doing, you do not understand now, but afterwards you will. And as they did, so we can and should, because all is now clear. And there are just two reasons that he gives here. Two things for us to learn from this strange scene of foot washing. The first is this. The washing of the disciples' feet explains the significance of Jesus' death, which is imminent. It's a kind of acted parable, really. And there are three aspects, at least, which we can take on board in explaining the significance of his forthcoming death. First of all, it's deliberate. Now, back in chapter 10, Jesus has said, you may remember this, no one takes my life. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it up again. And he does something very similar here with the towel. No one made him lay aside his garments. No one made him pick up the towel again at the end. It's true that Judas has his part to play. Verse 2, the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot to betray him. Yes, he has his part to play, but it, evil though that action is, it doesn't take Jesus by surprise. He says in verse 11, or we read in verse 11, that he knew who was to betray him. No surprise here, Judas plays his evil part, but what happens is deliberate. And it is sobering to watch Jesus washing the feet of Judas, along with all the others, just being there and being part of a ritual is not in itself adequate. Sometimes people think that just turning up in church, receiving bread and wine at communion or whatever, somehow makes him a part of things. We need to beware of that. Judas's feet were washed along with the others. And Jesus does it all deliberately. Verse 4, he rose from supper, he laid aside his outer garments, and taking a towel, tied it round his waist. He laid aside his outer garments. There's a song we used to sing. I don't think we've sung it here for years. We did many years ago. Older ones may remember it. We used to sing a lot. You laid aside, your majesty, gave up everything for me, suffered at the hands of those you had created. You laid aside, your majesty. It was a lovely song, actually, but songs come and go. And so here he lays aside his outer garments. Before long, of course, this action will be reversed. Soldiers will come and will take his garments from him. And not just the outer one, of course, but all of them. And they will then nail him to a cross. And he will let them do it. It's deliberate. He lays aside his outer garments and wraps a towel round his waist. It's all acted parable. He knows what he's doing. He does it deliberately. So his death is deliberate. It's also loving. It's how John begins, verse 1. Having loved his own who were to the world, were in the world, he loved them to the end. He showed them the full extent of his love. His death is a loving death. Loving because it's what was necessary in order for our being made clean, for us to be made clean. It's loving because of what it achieved. And people often miss this, don't they? I hope we don't hear in our church. There was no other way in which we could be made clean. We've sung a lot tonight about sin being washed away. And this is a loving death because that's what it achieves. In verse 10, Jesus says, the one who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you. It's a marvelous thing to be told. The one who has bathed, who has come to Christ for cleansing, does not need to wash again, just his feet. In other words, the Christian life is not like a game of snakes and ladders. Do you remember playing that? Maybe you still do, quietly, when nobody's looking. It's great fun, isn't it? Easy. You get almost to the end, and then you land on square 86. Total disaster. back to square one, Sonia, and then all over again. But in the Christian life, however bad the snake, we never have to go back to square one if we belong to Jesus. Never have to go back there. As he says, if you had a bath, you don't need another one. Feet get a bit messy. Keep them clean. Wash the dust off. In other words, what we do need to do is constantly to keep short accounts with God. Be quick to repent when we erred and strayed. Ask his forgiveness. Wipe the dust. Pick up and press on. His is a loving death. It makes us clean when we put our trust in him. See what love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God. And so we are. It's deliberate, it's loving, and the other thing, thirdly, it's very humbling, this death of Jesus, because it is only pride and nothing else at the end of the day which will prevent anyone from coming to Jesus. Only pride will do that. There may be other difficulties along the way, but at the end of the day, that is the only issue. That's Peter's problem to begin with. He won't let Jesus be his servant. Verse 8, you'll never wash my feet. And it sounds very good, doesn't it? He thinks it's very shocking, like the Queen cleaning the loo. It sounds good. It's actually very proud. Because Peter is actually telling the Son of God what he can and can't do. Jesus just said he's going to do it. Peter says you're not. It's not actually as good as it sounds. He will not let Jesus be his servant. And Jesus says, effectively, if you won't let me be your servant, you can't have anything to do with me. If I do not wash you, you have no share with me. And he would say the same to anyone today. We must come to Jesus. The invitation is open. We must come individually. Nobody can come for us. But we must come in the right way, which is humbly, and not with our head held high. Not to flatter him, not as if we are doing him some favor. Here's another chorus. I don't think we sing this at summer camp, but I sung it countless times at camps in the past. There's a way back to God from the dark paths of sin. There's a door that is open and you may go in. At Calvary's cross is where you begin when you come as a sinner to Jesus. And people are very reluctant to do that. It offends them. It hurts their pride. They may be delightful in all sorts of ways. They may be charming. They may be the most kind and helpful neighbors. The nicest possible people to have live next door and so on. But they will not come as sinners to Jesus. And Jesus says, if I don't wash you, if you won't let me wash you clean, you're left with the muck. And if you and I have come as sinners to Jesus, then it is only because he has enabled us to see ourselves as we really are. It's no credit to us. Repentance and faith are his gift to us. No greater gift to receive. If you haven't received it yet, then ask. It's a gift he loves to give. So that's the first thing. This foot washing is an acted parable. It shows us the significance of his deliberate, loving, humbling gift of himself to death on a cross for our sake. But the second thing here is every bit as important. And we need both, not one or the other. We need the first. We also need the second, which is that we have in this foot washing an example to follow. And that's very plain because he says so himself, verse 14. Or 13, or 12 actually. Do you understand what I've done for you? To you, you call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. And from time to time, people take that literally. So you might find an Anglican bishop in his purple robe kneeling on a pavement somewhere, and washing the feet of people passing by. And there's nothing wrong with that. It can be quite touching. But it can actually miss the point entirely, because the point of the action here is what it shows about Jesus' inner person, his genuine humility, the servant nature of his heart and mind. Whereas if I sat on the pavement washing people's feet, I could easily be thinking, oh, well done me, what a good boy am I. I might even get my picture in the Courier. And anyway, smelly feet are not an issue in our country, even on a day like today, in the way they are constantly in the Middle East. So passers-by might well be baffled if you offered to wash their feet, might be slightly offended. What's wrong with my feet? So you can miss the point if we just do it literally. It's a very far cry from what Jesus means when he says we should do as he has done. What he means very simply is that we must learn to serve like him, and not only can, but must. And service is alien to us, isn't it? Being a servant of others, it's certainly alien to me. I like other people to be there for me, rather than the other way around. And since there's a fair chance you're as sinful as I am, I suspect the same is true of you. We come into the world thinking we are the centre of it, and we carry that attitude with us as we grow up into adulthood. And of course, our culture actively encourages it in a way it used not to. So self-denial is not highly regarded today. All the pressure is in the other direction, is to be true to yourself and express yourself rather than deny yourself and put others, God first and others second and self last. And Jesus' way stands in marked contrast here as an attitude of service in both the church and the world. And we are to follow him in serving one another within the church and in the world outside. So first of all, the local church, Christian community, is to be a serving community. Jesus says to his disciples, as I have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. So it's internal, if you like, to begin with. They are to care for one another. They are to look out for one another. They are to serve one another. That's the right attitude within the Christian family, Christian fellowship. And it reminds me of an email I received several years ago, from a man, a Christian man, a professing Christian man, who'd recently moved to Tunbridge Wells and had come with his wife and family to an August morning service. Now, August morning service is a better resource than they used to be. But I didn't meet him. I was on holiday at the time, but he sent a long email to me a day or two afterwards, describing his reaction to our Sunday morning gathering. And it was a long email, printed out. It came to two sides of A4 paper. Basically, he hadn't been very impressed. Before he'd become a Christian, he'd been put off by church services he'd attended, and he felt it would be helpful for me to know, as vicar, how we could improve ours. And some of the things he said were spot on, really. Others less so. He said the sermon was far too long and boring. There wasn't enough for the children, very off-putting for them, and so on and so on. And he was right in many ways, not all of them. But he gave the game away in his last sentence. He said they didn't think they'd be coming back. He said, we will continue to look elsewhere for a church more likely to meet our needs. And to be honest with you, I'm not really very sorry that they went elsewhere. I have no idea who they were. I don't even remember the name. And of course, I am thankful when people do feel able to come to a church because they have needs and they don't know where else to turn. That is good, and we ought to see more of it. I wish we did, really. And it's great if those needs can be met by genuine service. But if established, professing Christian people arrive looking for a church that will meet our needs, they will not improve the fellowship that they join. The servant does not come for what he or she can get out of it. He or she does not leave a Christian gathering saying, it didn't do much for me. He or she comes for the benefit of others and is genuinely concerned for their welfare and their spiritual welfare, their growth in godliness, their closeness to Christ, most of all. This morning, over coffee time, after the morning service, a friend I hadn't seen for a while learned that I'd been a bit poorly for the past couple of weeks. He hadn't known that, and he said, I'll pray for you. Now, that was kind. I said, thank you. Now, I know him, and I'm quite sure what he meant by that was, I'll pray for you getting better. And it's nice that he would pray for me to get better. And I'll have to ask him next week, that's what he was going to pray for. I should have said, yeah, thank you, please pray for me to get back into my Bible. Because when I don't feel well, I don't get into my Bible. I find it difficult, and I find it very hard to pray. And my quiet times go up the spout. So, yes, do please pray for me, but pray for that aspect of my life. I will probably get well again anyway. That's nice to pray. But the other is not guaranteed. So serve me in that way, by looking out for my spiritual state and need, and not just that I feel a bit under the weather. Now, what John says at the beginning of chapter 13 is very significant here in this attitude of service. He says something very significant in verse 3. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going back to God, rose from supper. He had come from God, he was going back to God. He knew where he'd come from, he knew where he was going to, and so he was secure. And he knew his place in God's purpose, and he was therefore free to lay aside his garments, his security, if you like, and put on a towel and wash his disciples' feet. And it reminds us that it is only the secure who can serve. People who are secure in Christ and his acceptance of them, of us, secure in that way in the knowledge of their place in God's good and ongoing purpose. So this is addressed to Christians serving one another initially, but of course if service begins in the church, it certainly must not end there. So in verse 20, truly, truly, I say to you, whoever receives the one I send receives me, and whoever receives me receives the one who sent me. We're to be out in the world serving it for the sake of Jesus and doing it as he has done. And of course that's picked up constantly through the rest of the New Testament. As Paul says, that lovely verse in 2 Corinthians 4, what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. What we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord. And we believe absolutely in proclamation. Of course we do. The gospel is good news, not just good advice. And that news needs to be heard. Then people can't believe in Jesus if they're not told about Jesus. But the second half of the verse is equally important, isn't it? Ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. It is the visible service of others for the sake of Christ, which gives authenticity to what we say. It was always so. If you remember coming to Christ, you think back to how it happened, I guarantee, almost guarantee, that the example and the humble service of somebody else or of some other people had a big part to play. And that service often shows itself in little ways. And we've been praying about camps just now. The season of camps is with us, or recently has been. And I remember once a lad on a Christian summer camp who bumped into one of the leaders in the afternoon and said, hi, Fred, I'm going for a swim. Why don't you come too? And Fred, or whatever his name was, said, yeah, sure, and came and joined him for a swim. Later on, this lad discovered that that very same leader, Jim, had actually just had a swim and had got himself dry and changed back into his normal clothes. But, you see, he was there to serve the youngsters. And so when this youngster said, I'm going to swim, come and join me, he said, yeah, of course. So he went. So often it's in little things, isn't it? It doesn't have to be vast acts of service. It's just an attitude which will show itself in all sorts of little things. And people will notice because it is different from the world around. That was actually a very Christ-like thing to do in its little way. Ourselves, your servants, for Jesus' sake. So if you know these things, says Jesus here, blessed are you if you do them.